Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. You've just been listening to music of, I think, one of the best, most wonderful orchestras in the world. You've heard of the Boston Pops. They're amazing. Going back to the days when Arthur Fiedler sort of started as the first conductor, and John Williams and his work. And since 1995, I think, the conductor, the head of it all, Keith Lockhart, has been at the helm. And how thrilled I am that he's going to join us here on the podcast to talk about a Chicago event coming up. Conductor Lockhart, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to talk to you. Yes, I have been there for 22 years, which every now and then I stare at in disbelief, but, you know, the calendar doesn't lie.
Now, what is the proper? Do we call you Maestro?
No, please call me Keith. Maestro sounds a lot older than I care to be.
Okay. I'll bet you Arthur Fiedler liked being called Maestro.
Yes. I don't think he was allowed to be called anything else.
I love it. Well, not
only, changed.
Not only do you have this critical role with the Boston Pops, but this is not all you do, right? Because you are also a conductor for BBC Concert Orchestra in London. You do North Carolina, the Brevard Music Center. I mean, you're a lot of places.
Well, you know, most conductors inhabit more than one podium, and these all nest fairly well. I do have one of the BBC orchestras in London, just got back from a week with them, and they're just a wonderful bunch of players and, a really supportive musical community. And then I have a summer festival in Western North Carolina that trains about 400 school and college students every summer and play some great music along the way. So I have a lot of wonderful things to do, and then sprinkle in a little guest conducting here and there, and I see my family every now and then.
I love it. Well, so I need a little history from you, because I know the Boston Symphony Orchestra, that was founded back in 1885. How do we get from
Boston Symphony was founded in 1881, and the Boston Pops was founded in 1885, in the fourth year of existence of the Boston Symphony. Partly, I think, the practical reason was that at that point, the season for the Boston Symphony Orchestra was only about 20 weeks long, and all the musicians would turn around and head back. They were at that point entirely European, entirely German, actually, up until the First World War. And they all went back, and then they would take other jobs, and the attrition rate was just horrible. They kept having to hire a new orchestra every year. So they decided that they would found an orchestra that could play a different kind of concerts based on kind of European summer beer garden concerts and the London proms and things that, European-educated fathers and mothers of the BSO were familiar with to extend their season. But I think there's more to it than that. I think they founded the Boston Pops because they also wanted to extend the range, the broadness of their support.
And that's kind of where I was going with it, because when people think of symphony orchestras, look, there are people who love that, and there are people who think, no, thank you. Send me to Broadway. I'm going to do something else. And when you look at the Boston Pops, it is that entity which says, no, we want to reach young people. We want to bring new people into this world. And I think, and actually under your guidance, is it fair enough to say you've actually taken the Pops in all sorts of new directions? You have been on a mission to reach a broader and younger audience.
Well, I think, the job of the orchestra has always been for this 130 years to not play to the choir, not preach to the choir, to play to people who don't think of themselves first and foremost as being particularly classical music fans. And by that, to open up a whole range of musical expression to people who otherwise might miss. And, my job as conductor there for the last nearly a quarter century is to continue that and to kind of reinterpret what that means, because, of course, this is up against a culture that has shifted a whole lot since 1885.
The reason we're talking is because, aside from the fact that I love you, is the fact that you are coming to Chicago, and on March 31st at the historic Auditorium Theater, no better place to play, we will hear the Boston Pops Esplanade Orchestra. I'm going to mention who your guest is in a minute. I'm not going to quite go there yet. It's going to be a fantastic evening. I got excited as soon as I saw you were coming, but I do want to note that as you do perform around the country, around the world, it is not unusual that you get joined by incredible, oftentimes very popular stars, like Chris Botti, Sting, John Mayer, Steven Tyler, right? It is not unusual for the Boston Pops to be joined by a star from a related realm.
It is not unusual at all, and indeed, if you look over the course of these last 20 years, the number of people that I have had the chance to collaborate with in all fields of musical endeavor, I mean, from country artists to rock and rollers to Yo-Yo Ma and Itzhak Perlman, I mean, it really goes in great Broadway stars, all those directions, and that's always fun. And, you know, for a lot of them, I have to say, they say, you know, it's always been, when I was a kid, I thought maybe someday I'd get to sing with the Boston Pops, and here I am. So.
And first we read, because it was first released, I don't know that you track this, it was released that the Boston Pops was coming to Chicago at the Auditorium. I'm already lining up my tickets. I'm ready to go. And then, and then I think it was a couple of weeks later, they issue a release that goes, and by the way, not only is Keith Lockhart and the Boston Pops coming, but he is going to be joined on stage by none other than three-time Tony Award-winning actor and singer. If you love Broadway, you know who I'm talking about, Bernadette Peters. How amazing is that?
As if it couldn't get in any better, right?
So. Really? I mean, now, have you and Bernadette worked together before?
Oh, probably a dozen times in this last decade or so. So we know each other pretty well by this point.
But she has actually she's not been on a Chicago stage for over a decade. So you actually, this sort of joining in Chicago is the first time for her in over a decade.
This is like a coup then. Now, Bernadette is great. I mean, she is such a talent, such just a radiant star, one of those people who takes the stage and holds it like very few people ever have or will. She still sounds gorgeous. You know, she's been in Broadway shows for practically 50 years now and is still one of the most beautiful creatures I've ever seen on the stage.
She might not appreciate us mentioning that 50 years on Broadway, but it is what it is, right?
But, you know, the playbills don't lie.
That's right. No, because if people who remember, she was in Gypsy and Annie Get Your Gun and Into the Woods and Sunday in the Park with George. I think the first time I saw her live myself was Sunday in the Park on Broadway with Mandy Patinkin, which was such an amazing.
And she was amazing in that.
Oh, my God, yes. And by the way, for the younger people who will come to this concert, they know her and are listening to this podcast. They know her from Smash, which I thought was one of the greatest shows ever, and why it didn't make it, I don't know. and Ugly Betty and Mozart in the Jungle. So very well known. But now I have to ask you. So there's the Boston Pops under your direction doing great stuff, and I know the kind of stuff you're going to play, and I'm thinking, I don't know that, you know, that Bernadette, she's not going to, how do you make that happen? Are we going to get some of you, some of her? What will the night look
like? Well, we're basically going to, the first half of the stage, the first half of the concert is a truncated part of what we're doing on the rest of this tour. The tour is throughout the Midwest in Kansas City, Iowa City, in South Dakota, which I think is very cool because I've never performed in South Dakota before, Indianapolis, et cetera, et cetera. When we come to Chicago, we are going to play part of our Gershwin program, the overture to Nice Work If You Can Get, reorchestrated for the Boston Pops by the guy who did the show orchestrations for that revival a couple of years ago. And then the original, a reconstruction of Paul Whiteman's version of An American in Paris, followed by the original Whiteman orchestration of Rhapsody in Blue. And then we'll go away for intermission and we'll come back and share the stage with one of the greatest Broadway performers ever.
And is she touring with you? So when you mentioned South Dakota, these other places, are you with her already?
Nope, it's just for Chicago. It's a special evening.
So you got to figure out rehearsal time in there somewhere.
We'll be doing that in Chicago, I think, not day of. But as I said, we go back a long way, and we've performed most of the stuff we'll be performing. We have performed with her before.
You know, I just want you to know, if she doesn't show up, I can do Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah, but can you do Fever? and do we want you to do Fever?
No, this is where the negotiation comes in, Keith. But I'm telling you, I'm one of the best Tevyas you'll ever want to have on stage. talk to me about your background, because I mean, you are classically trained, and you of course you were from Poughkeepsie, New York. Maybe that's where a lot of the New York Broadway stuff comes from. But talk to me about your own musical interests and how you end up loving the music that you perform now.
Well, I think it's because, you're right, I was raised in Poughkeepsie. I was the child of two IBMers, neither of whom were really musicians of any serious sort. And so even though I was very serious about music, I wasn't really pre-tracked into any particular things. I wasn't told, well, this is good music and this is not good music and you shouldn't listen to this. So I grew up kind of in an omnivorous sort of musical way. people who just liked music, and that has served me well because I love music of Broadway. I spent quite a bit of my early professional career doing more music theater than anything else. I love the rock and roll I grew up with. I love jazz. You know, all those things. I never spent a whole lot of time thinking about, well, this is really serious music and this isn't, you know. And so even though I'm trained as, you know, any other classical conductor is, and love to be on the podium doing, you know, a Mahler symphony with huge forces assembled, I like this stuff as well. And I like the mission of the Boston Pops to kind of break down those preconceived notions about you know, what we find worthy and what we find less so.
And talk to me about what it's like performing in Chicago on the auditorium stage. This has to be one of your favorite venues and places to be. Tell me it is.
Oh, it's great. It's always great being back in Chicago. I haven't performed there often. I have to say, in the last few years, you were saying Bernadette hadn't been there for a while. I'm trying to think of the last time I performed in Chicago. We brought the Pops there several times. We played the Rosemont Horizon down near lovely O'Hare.
Yeah, gorgeous area.
We've been in the auditorium a couple of times. We've been to Ravinia several times, but that hasn't happened for a while either. And I used to, in the early mid-90s, I did quite a few kind of single concerts with Chicago, with the symphony. But it's always great to, it's a great town to be in.
The auditorium theater, it's incredible.
Yeah, it has that grand Gilded Age sort of look to it, and it's a fun physical space to perform in, and a great place for this kind of a concert, I think.
I don't mean for this question to be unfair, and I'll tell you why I'm asking it.
With an intro like that.
Yeah, right. Uh-oh, where are we going? Well, no, here, look, I remember back in 2010 that, and this was under your leadership, that you guys have commissioned lots of different works, and the one I remember was sort of a tribute to the Kennedy brothers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, to me, there's an element of politics that comes up in the world of music, and these days, under this current administration, the arts are truly under attack. I don't have to tell you the threats to completely defund the National Endowment for the Arts. So I'm not going political with you in terms of what do you think about the president or anything, but what I do want to ask you is, how important are the arts and the support of the arts by a government, by the people? Some people just think this is luxury stuff. It's not important. We need bullets and guns.
Well, I think it's no surprise to you to find out that I'm appalled by the current using of the paltry funding for the NEH and ANA as a political football. But I'm not surprised by it, I'm afraid. How important are the arts? The arts in terms of education, in terms of it being in young people's lives, and in terms of being in all of our lives as a expression of our humanity, are, I think, pretty much essential to perseverance of the preserving of a society. I think that it is so short-sighted and so myopic to think that a government's job is merely to provide bullets and roads. A government's job is to provide a life for its citizens that makes that place worth living in. And the fact that the National Endowment for the Arts is under attack is a joke, because the amount of money spent per capita on the National Endowment for the Arts, if you sneezed, you wouldn't notice it.
Well, actually, I did see one comment, which was, I know that I'm going to get hate email for this, but somebody said, you know, if Melania Trump just lived in Washington and not New York, we would cover the National Endowment for the Arts budget, because that's what it's costing.
I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
I made a speech years ago, must be probably 18, 19 years ago, at National Press Club, in which I held up a first-class postage stamp, which was even less than it is now. It was probably 34 cents or 36 cents or something like that, and said, this is the cost of the National Endowment for the Arts for every taxpaying U.S. citizen.
Yeah. And you made the point.
36 cents.
We'll see what point you make here on March 31st. Maybe you'll have something to say. By the way, congratulations on receiving the 2017 Commonwealth Awards for Achievement. It's the highest award. I actually lecture at Harvard a few times every year, so I'm familiar with it. And the highest award that can be given in the arts by the Commonwealth. And I hope I'm not ruining a surprise. You knew you were getting that, right?
Oh, I did know. I thought the award ceremony has already happened last month. And,
oh, good.
And,
I realized as I was saying that, going, wait a minute, what if they haven't told him yet?
No, it's obviously an honor, and I accept it in the spirit of it, in many ways, being a reward for an award for Boston Pops and for what this institution has done and meant to this area for the last century.
Well, and I want to thank you for what you've done and what you've meant to the growth of the Boston Pops, the popularity of the Boston Pops. Look, I'm not a big symphony guy, I'm going to be honest with you, but my whole life I've been in love with the Boston Pops. And
That's great. And so
I just can't wait. I encourage everybody, you can get tickets. They ain't that expensive. They even start at $33. You can go to auditoriumtheater.org. And you know, Keith, you know how you know that you're playing at the proper place? Because in the website, auditoriumtheater.org, they spell theater, T-R-E, the way it should be spelled.
Well, you are. Okay, I know we're in a highfalutin joint now.
Exactly. None of that T-E-R stuff going on here, T-R-E. The phone number is 312-341-2300. And if you have never been to the Auditorium Theater, listeners, to experience it for the first time, or in my case, the millionth time, by listening to the Boston Pops Orchestra and Bernadette Peters with them, I got to tell you, there's no way this thing isn't a sellout. I've actually had people calling me because they know I'm active with the Auditorium Theater saying, I got to get tickets. What can you do to help me get tickets? And I use my connections to say, go online and buy them like everybody else.
That's what we like to hear.
Exactly.
Anyway, I'll look forward to seeing you there, and we really appreciate the support.
You will. Keith Lockhart, thank you so much. Maestro, I'll just say that once. Thank you for your time. Look forward to seeing you that night. And break a leg while you're in Chicago. You're going to be wonderful.
Thanks, Paul. Take care now.
Bye-bye. Always ongoing action of the Trump administration days. This week, we've gotten into Supreme Court nominations. It seems to get distracted and detracted a lot to other things, but the Supreme Court nomination of Neil Gorsuch is underway. Speech is done on day one, questioning going on for a few days. I thought we should step in and talk about that and some other things with one of my favorite guests, Professor Robert Shapiro. He's a professor over at St. Xavier University, and always you see him a lot on my Politics Tonight TV show. Now we get him on the podcast. Robert, welcome to the podcast. Appreciate it.
Hi, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Well, same here. So, look, you are not only a professor, you're a lawyer, so you're the perfect person to talk about. As I've been listening to Judge Gorsuch answer questions, like a good Supreme Court nominee that he is, he's been evasive of anything that or downright, you know, refusing to answer anything that would have anything to do with cases that could confront him on the bench. How are senators supposed to get a sense of what he's really all about?
Well, they have a lot of background on him, first of all. I mean, that's really important. He's been a judge for a decade or so, and he's done a lot of writing, a lot of speaking. So they know a lot about how he approaches issues. And really, that's the kind of question that they can ask him, is how would you approach a certain matter? What are the things you take into consideration? What are the kinds of sources you would use to try to understand a case and decide a case? He actually made a very interesting statement yesterday, or I guess Monday it was, in which he said, look, I decide cases. And what he meant by that was every case is different. Every case is unique. So I can't tell you just sitting here now what I'm going to do in an individual case, because it all has facts that that are going to vary from other cases, are going to present matters in a particular way. And he said, I try to decide each one of those as it goes along. He cited to a former Supreme Court justice who used this rule. And that's, you know, it's appropriate for him to say, I can't tell you how I'm going to come out in a particular case because I don't know what facts are going to be presented to me. But I can tell you how I go about deciding a particular case.
That makes perfect sense, obviously. And in fact, if he were to come out and say, absolutely, give me a Roe versus a Wade abortion case, it's out of here. I mean, he would never make it to the court. Aside from what the position is, it would show that he doesn't have the proper temperament for a justice. But that being said, you know, I remember John Roberts, current Chief Justice, in his testimony during this process, you know, said, look, I think judges are we're umpires. We call balls and strikes. We don't set law. And then, of course, he gets on the court and absolutely sets law between Citizens United and even Obamacare supporting it. The truth is, when Donald Trump said, I will absolutely be appointing justices who will reverse Roe versus Wade, and the Heritage Foundation gives him a list that goes, here you go. And by the way, Neil Gorsuch is on the second list we gave you. Doesn't that give some confidence, even though Judge Gorsuch says, can't tell you what I'm going to do, but is there some real life? If you were a senator, or would you say, well, we kind of do know what he might do?
Well, you've got some sense of it. He clearly has a conservative approach, what we call a conservative approach to the law, and he has a devotion to what some people call originalism, although there are probably as many different versions of originalism as there are of the living Constitution, which is sometimes viewed as its opposite. So we have some idea of how he's going to go about it. But as I said, every case is different. So you have an understanding of sort of what legal principles he will adhere to, but how it's going to show up in a particular case and how it's going to operate in a particular case is an interesting question. Roe versus Wade is sort of interesting in this respect. It's been on the books now for a good long time, over 40 years.
Sure.
And
1973.
You have Judge Gorsuch, if he becomes Justice Gorsuch, is going to confront this. He claims to have a conservative approach to making decisions. Well, a conservative judicial figure is going to believe in stare decisis, that you stand by the precedent. Even if you think they're wrong, you stand by the precedent. And a case that's been so much on the books and there's been so much jurisprudence on, you would be very hesitant to overturn. And I think they could say to him, what's your attitude towards, you know, longstanding cases, even if you think they're wrong? And I'd be interested to hear his answer to that question.
Well, he has been getting, he's been getting some of those, and his answer from time to time when he gets them are along the lines of, precedent is precedent. You have to respect that. My job is to, you know, as a federal judge, is to follow precedent. But then Senator Lindsey Graham threw something interesting at him. Senator Graham said, you know, I'm trying to get through some legislation here that will recognize life essentially at the 20th month. You know, the Supreme Court was clear in Roe versus Wade mm-hmm. that women mm-hmm. can do as they choose in the first 3 months. Then it gets a bit sticky after that. And right. Senator Graham said, look, I think at 20 months, there's some science that says fetuses can feel excruciating pain. And indeed, if there is an abortion, anesthetic is used on the baby itself. And he's got this whole theory he put out there. And he looked at Gorsuch and said, you know, if that passes and gets through, he goes, it will make its way up to you. Didn't ask him for an opinion on it because he knew that wasn't proper to do. But my point is, Bob, it's not about reversing Roe versus Wade, which is possible, but it certainly is about adding more and more restrictions, right? Ever since the Casey case in 1992, that's what these cases do. They just push restrictions so it's tougher and tougher for women to make that choice.
Well, not in every instance, because the court has, even the conservatives on the court have gone in the other direction as well. I think if, you know, in handling that question, I don't think it's a hard one for him to do, because what he would have to say is, well, I'd have to understand what the science is behind this. Is the law, does it meet the high standards we set for certain kinds of constitutionally related decisions, things of that sort. It is true that generally speaking, it's within the broader framework of Roe versus Wade, the court has been deciding you can do this, you can't do that, you can do this, you can't do that. But again, in every instance, it's had to look at the specific facts. You think about the Texas abortion clinic decisions, the way in which they went about that, it had a lot to do with the specific facts of the case. And they do that in every instance. And that's why the cases keep coming up, because there's a new set of facts. And under those new set of facts, you have to decide, okay, how are the principles that I thought were most important applicable to this particular set of facts? And that's what I think he keeps emphasizing. And I think that that's the right thing to emphasize for any judge and any conservative judge, that what you have to do is, you know, try to understand what the basic principles are of the law and apply them to the specific facts that come before them. And I think that's what's happened in the Roe versus Wade context. A lot of the judges have thought, well, some of this goes too far, some of this doesn't go far enough, and they try to work it through in each particular instance.
And that's kind of where the personal views come in, right? If you are a pro-life person, you're probably more likely to find restrictions to be okay, right? Because it's sort of your worldview. I will say Gorsuch, to his credit, said what you said, which is, you know, I look at the precedent, I look at the facts, and I have a decision to make. The toughest on him has been, I think, Senator Illinois' own Senator Dick Durbin, who basically is throwing his own words back at him. And one decision involving sort of a workers' rights thing where everybody went one way and Gorsuch goes the other way, not protecting rights on the in this particular case involving a trucker. And Gorsuch said, look, you know, it's a tough decision, but the law is the law and the president is the president. In other words, not really tying it to being a Republican or being a Democrat or being liberal or being conservative. His view, and probably any judge's view, is I look at the facts, I have the law, and I make what I think is as fair a connection between those two as I can.
That's right. And a good judge, I think, always has to recognize that he or she comes to the circumstance with certain kinds of biases or whatever because of their background and whatever. Famous case of this Justice Brennan, who was Catholic, nevertheless set aside in many instances his personal view for carrying out what he thought the law required. And a good judge always does that. Nobody can be absolutely certain or clear about all of their underlying biases and prejudices. But a good judge always says, now, am I really making this decision on the basis of the principle of the law, or has my personal view, view for living my own life, has that somehow interfered, confused, or clouded my judgment? And one of the things I think that that the senators are looking for is this a guy who really is going to approach the matter in as neutral a fashion as a human being can and try to apply the laws? Now, you're right. He has certain things that he believes are the principles that the laws are designed to uphold, and those are always going to have an impact. But those hopefully have been determined by his scholarship, by his study, by his experience in the law, and not just from personal prejudice or personal opinion.
You know, Gorsuch himself clerked for two Supreme Court justices,
right.
Anthony Kennedy, who's currently on the court. That would be an interesting pairing if he's there. And also Justice Byron White. And Justice White, for folks who, you know, don't necessarily remember this or aren't into it, was an appointment by JFK, which would tell you he's a liberal guy, except he turned out to be anything but. The same way David Souter, who was a George H.W. Bush appointee, was meant to be conservative, and he turned out to be anything but. What do you think is it, Bob, that happens when somebody gets to the Supreme Court? Do things, even though you have certain personal views, then there's people like Scalia who don't move at all or shift or don't seem to, or Clarence Thomas. But is there sort of a weight that comes on the shoulders of a Supreme Court justice to say, you know what, this just isn't about political views and I need to see things in a different way? And sometimes it's the opposite of the way I would have otherwise seen it.
Yeah, I think this is something that happens frequently. I mean, Justice Blackmun is maybe one of the more famous ones. I mean, you know, who was appointed as a very, very conservative justice and often wasn't. The most famous case, of course, in our lifetime is Earl Warren, who was the Republican governor of California and ended up as the Supreme Court justice that made the greatest number of changes in the way in which the court went about handling certain of the decisions. I think what happens on the court is that it's a huge responsibility. It really is. And there are two aspects always to the law, as you know. One is, what does the law say? And then there's this principle out there that every justice has to ask, and that is this a fair result? Is this a just result? And often you find that although the law seems to direct you in one particular direction, the outcome seems not to be right, and this is what we call equity. You have to do what you think is right, and you also have to think through what are the implications of this for the future, because I'm deciding not just for today. I'm deciding for next year, next decade, next half century, next century. All of those people are going to be affected by what I do. And am I certain that what I'm doing now is not going to have a very negative effect either on the society or on individual people subsequently in a way that I don't want to happen? And I think that has sometimes a certain liberalizing impact on even conservative justices. And I think that's one of the things that you see on the court. The one thing about Judge Gorsuch is he's a very thoughtful man. And that's one of the things that I think speaks well for him, because he doesn't have the sense, and he actually said this in the opening day, that he knows it all. And I think part of the problem that we sometimes encounter with justices on both liberal and conservative is they think they already know. Well, he's always questioning his own judgment, and I think that's a very good attribute for a Supreme Court justice.
He's shown himself during the hearings to be self-deprecating from time to time, at one point calling himself a monkey, a teacher that had to teach monkeys like me. He's good sense of humor, very, very likable. And so in many of the Republican senators have said, look, you know, I voted yes for Obama appointees. There is no question that Gorsuch is competent. There can be no challenge. You will have, I think, the Dick Durbins of the world saying, no, his views are outside the mainstream. But ultimately, my question is, can we expect 8 Democrats to make their way over to give it to him? Or do you think that anger towards Merrick Garland never even getting a hearing will propel Democrats to stay together, regardless of the competence, even if you disagree with his views, of Neil Gorsuch?
You know, I'm really uncertain whether they're going to bring that over. And that's partly bring 8 over. And that's partly because matters on Capitol Hill become so partisan. And I think that there's a sense of among the Democrats in particular, well, it's true in the Republicans, too, a need for solidarity. And I think that's the way the Merrick Garland thing has primarily affected this, is not so much that people say, oh, they did it to us, we're going to do it to them, but a sense of we need to band together, because if we don't band together, we're really going to be at the mercy of, you know, the those on the other side of the aisle. I think that's affecting both parties. So I think that's the reason that you may not get enough crossovers. But there's a countervailing political influence, which is that many of these senators, Democratic senators, are up for re-election in another couple of years, and they don't want to appear to be frustrating what it is they think those in their electorate have expected from this administration. Many of these Democrats are up for re-election in states that President Trump carried. So that's having a little bit of a countervailing influence. It's very hard to predict how this is going to come out. I think most of the senators recognize that this is an appointment where you really cannot question his capabilities to be a Supreme Court justice. So the partisanship issue is going to have a very unusual impact on how it is they ultimately go.
And we will.
They're going to feel a certain need to go one way, but at the same time, for political reasons, feel the need to go the other way. And it's very uncertain how that's going
to happen. Will know in early April exactly what they're going to do, according to Senator McConnell. That's what he wants to call for the vote. My friend, Robert Shapiro, professor at St. Xavier University and lawyer extraordinaire, thanks for your time and insight. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Paul. It's always a pleasure.
All right, we'll do it again soon. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.